Our next speaker, Dr. Zhou, or Professor Schwartz, really needs no introduction to those of us living in Montreal. But Dr. Schwartz is a director of the McGill University's Office for Science and Society, whose mandate is to demystify science for the public, the media, and students. Dr. Schwartz also teaches a variety of courses in McGill University's chemistry department and in the Faculty of Medicine with emphasis on health issues, including aspects of alternative medicine. We hope that he would also come and teach some courses here as well. He is well known for his informative and entertaining, so pressure, for public lectures on topics ranging from the chemistry of love, which according to Professor Dis is food, of course, as well as for the science of aging, which I think some of us are already there. So Professor Schwartz has received numerous awards for teaching chemistry and for interpreting science for the public, has written several books, has appeared on television and radio shows. I miss him on the Discovery Channel, as I was telling him earlier, and writes a weekly column for the Montreal Gazette, The Right Chemistry, which is, of course, is the right stuff. So please help me welcome Dr. Schwartz, a McGill alumnus.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be out here at our campus. It's unfortunate that we don't have more interaction between our campuses because you guys do a wonderful thing out here with food science. You know, it used to be that we would sit down to dinner and the only thing that mattered was what the food tasted like. If we liked it, we ate it. But things have changed. Today we look at food critically. We want to know if it contains nitrites. We want to know what other preservatives it may have. Indeed, eating has become a fright. People are worried about every morsel that goes into their mouth. They are confused. They don't know who to listen to. One day, it's butter that's killing us. The next day, it's margarine. And it all is very, very confusing. Indeed, eating has become a clinical experience. We want to know how much cholesterol there is in our food. Does it have any vitamin C? What are all of the ingredients? Food eating has become a very, very complex endeavor. But we are what we eat. So it's worthwhile to try to take out some of this confusion, to try to unravel some of that complexity. You know, the notion that we are what we eat is not just an old adage. It's a statement of scientific fact. Just think for a moment. From our earliest days, what do we construct ourselves of? It is whatever we shovel into our mouth. It is that grand collage of chemicals that we call food. That's what we are made up of. And I know that to a lot of people, that sounds confusing because people don't like to think of the fact that we are, in fact, just a large bag of chemicals. But that's what we are. I guess, according to Professor Thies, we're a gel, right? And we don't leak, although some of us reach an age where we leak a bit more than we would like to. But we are that large bag of chemicals. People think chemicals are found in a lab in a flask. No, they're inside of us, and we are constructed of the ones that comprise our food. We also are, however, what we read. That's where our knowledge comes from. That's how we know what chemicals we're made up of. We read scientific papers, we read books, we listen to radio, we listen to TV, but what we're really listening to is what those announcers have read and what the producers have done for them by reading the journal. So it all comes back to what we read. And that's where a lot of the confusion starts, because virtually every day, there's some new study that comes out that tells us what we should be afraid of or what we should eat in order to live forever. And it goes back and forth like that. One day we may find out that poutine is killing us. Well, we already heard some about poutine, that Quebec delicacy that, of course, is made with French fries that are fried in fat laden with trans fats. There's some cheese over it, which is fortified with cholesterol, and dripping over it is some gravy of unknown etiology. So we're not surprised that that isn't really great for us. But at the other side of the spectrum, we get information about what we should be eating. What is it? Well, depends on what has been in the news recently. This particular time, it was pomegranate. Well, pretty interesting. You know, the inference is that if this is what we eat, we'll have to forget all of our health problems. Why? What's the evidence? There it is, pomegranates. They've been prized since biblical times for their healing and anti-aging properties. Well, you know, coming from the realm of science, I'd like to have a bit more evidence than ancestry and reliance on authority. After all, bloodletting was around for 2,000 years before we figured out that this really wasn't the way to go. So just because pomegranates have been prized since the biblical era doesn't mean that they are any kind of a miraculous product. But it's interesting for us here because it does offer a springboard to get into the area of nutrition and health. So let's go back to those biblical times and let's take a look at the science there. Let's go back to the very beginning when Eve offered Adam an apple. That's what everybody says, except the Bible. The Bible does not say that. The Bible does not name the fruit of the tree of knowledge. That's the only label that is given to it. What is it? Well, why do we think it's the apple? Because that's the fruit that artists in the Middle Ages knew, and that's how they portrayed the fruit of the tree of knowledge. I don't know what it was, but I know what it wasn't. It was not an apple. Apples did not grow in that part of the Middle East till about the Middle Ages. So what was the fruit of the tree of knowledge? It could have been a pomegranate, because that did grow in that part of the world since antiquity. And you know what? It would not have been a bad choice for the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Why? Because when we do a chemical analysis of pomegranates, we find that they contain compounds called aromatase inhibitors. Some of you may have heard about these because they are used in chemotherapy. They are used in the treatment of breast cancer. Now, of course, they're not isolated from pomegranates. They're synthesized in laboratory and they're used in much higher doses. But it's an interesting area to investigate. Why? Because if you go into the laboratory and you take cultured breast cancer cells and you bathe them in pomegranate juice, it turns out they multiply less quickly. What does that really mean? It means that if you go into the laboratory and you take cultured breast cancer cells and bathe them in pomegranate juice, they multiply less quickly. That's all that it means. You cannot extrapolate from that to suggest that pomegranates are the solution to cancer. But of course, if you're an advertiser, you don't have to be limited by the science. You can extrapolate, and all of a sudden you can cheat death by drinking pomegranate juice. In fact, it's the super fruit. It's the physician in your cupboard. It is the stuff that allows you to live forever, right? Puts you on life support. Well, that's what the advertisers will tell you, and sometimes they get slapped on the wrist. Recently, Palm, the manufacturer, did have that happen to them in the U.S. by the Federal Trade Commission because they said, look, you've overstepped the boundaries. Indeed, we don't have any evidence to support the allegations that you're making based upon your product. But that just slows them down a little. They take a bit of a different approach. That's what advertisers do. Advertising basically is the art of taking half-truths and making whole lies out of them. And they're very, very good at that. Now, I don't have anything against pomegranates. I like them. We eat pomegranates, but they're not miracles. They're not going to solve all of our health problems the way that it is insinuated. Indeed, one could make such a case for virtually anything. I could try to make a case for you about dried apricots. Dried apricots are a real favorite food in the foothills of the Himalayas. That's the area where James Hilton focused his classic novel, Shangri-La. And, you know, they have supposedly impressive longevity there. You speak to the people, they say that they long lives, 120, they say. Well, unfortunately, they don't have any birth certificates. He may be 39, but it's a tough life there in the Himalayas. But they do eat a lot of dried apricots. I suspect that if they had charcoal-broiled steaks, they would rather eat that, right? If they had foods based on your notes technology, I'm sure they would rather eat that. But that's not what they have. What they have is dried apricots. And they say that they live to 120. That's not enough to suggest that apricots are some sort of miraculous food. But the industry, of course, will very quickly jump on that kind of a bandwagon. We in the scientific world, however, rely on peer-reviewed research. It isn't the end all, because, of course, a lot of nonsense gets published. We don't have to look further than what Andrew Wakefield has done. The anti-vaccination movement is totally based on a fraudulent paper published in The Lancet, one of the most respected journals in the world. But still, it is the best way to proceed, peer-reviewed literature. However, people have been interested in what to put into their mouth just long before peer-reviewed literature ever appeared on the scene. Indeed, if we go back to the ancient days of the Greeks, the Hippocrates. Well, Hippocrates certainly thought about food. In fact, he coined the expression, "Let thy food be thy medicine." And that was pretty inventive for those days. Today, it kind of seems second nature to us because we realize that, of course, food has to play an important role in our life. But back then, they didn't know anything about chemistry. They didn't understand physiology or biology. It was surprising that he would come up with a notion like that. Of course, not everything that Hippocrates said was equally clever. He also suggested that lettuce cooled the body and curbed the passion. We don't have any evidence for that. And he also said that pigeon droppings were great for baldness. Mercifully, you didn't have to eat them. You had to rub them on your bald head. But as you can see, from his empirical evidence, it did not work very well. On the other hand, he also suggested that flax was great for the intestines. And he was right about that. Flax, of course, contains soluble fiber, and it's indeed great for evacuation purposes. So you can see that back then, nutrition was really a mixture of sense and nonsense, very much like it is today. There's a lot of silliness out there, and of course, there's a lot of hard science. Unfortunately, the public is more readily seduced by the silliness, the miracle of the day, or the toxin du jour. And it varies from day to day. They vacillate back and forth. Well, in this case, Hippocrates was on the right track with flax, because when we take a look at flax close up, we find that there are some pretty interesting ingredients in there. Flax seeds contain omega-3 fats. You've heard about omega-3 fats. These are the ones that are mostly found in fish. They supposedly reduce the risk of cardiac arrhythmia. You give it to pregnant mothers. They give birth to children with higher IQs. We've all heard these kind of stories. Unfortunately, the omega-3 fat that's found in flaxseed is not identical to what we find in fish, but at least it's the next best thing. Flaxseed also contains lignans. You can demonstrate in laboratory experiments that they have anti-cancer properties. And of course, we have the fiber and all kinds of advantageous things about fiber in terms of reducing the risk of colon cancer. So there it is, flax. It could be portrayed as a miracle, and it often is. But no single food should be portrayed in that fashion. It is possible to never eat flax seeds and have a very, very good diet. It's possible to eat lots of flax seeds and still have a terrible diet. It's the overall composition of the diet that matters. And sure, flax can be a component of it. But people are looking for miracles. They're looking for geese that lay the golden egg. That's what everyone is interested in. Tell me what to eat that's going to keep me healthy forever. There's no simple answer to that, except from the quacks. The quacks will always have an answer. They will never say, I don't know. They always know what to do. They're usually wrong, but they always know what to do. There are no geese out there that lay golden eggs. But you know what? There are some chickens that do. At least for the farmer who's raising chickens that lay omega-3 eggs, because the profit margin on those is very high. How did this come about? Eggs have a checkered history. Why? Because, of course, the yolk is laden with cholesterol. Cholesterol is linked to heart disease, and therefore eggs are linked to heart disease. Egg sales have plummeted because of that. So egg producers thought, gee, what can we do to try to somehow improve our public profile? Well, while cholesterol, of course, has been cast into the shadows, the fact is that omega-3 fats have been basking in the limelight. Why? Because these fats that are found in fish have been linked to all the benefits that I suggested before. So the egg producers thought, gee, you know, how can we get some omega-3 fats into our eggs? Because that would be a good promotional venture. You can feed flax seeds to the chickens, or you can feed fish meal to the chickens. Either of those will work. They tried the fish meal first. It made the eggs taste fishy, not good. Flax seed, however, worked. So you get some flax seed, you feed it to the chickens, you get some eggs, you label them omega-3 eggs, you charge 3 times the price. People are willing to pay it because now they have something that they can eat that's going to be, quote, good for them. Of course, you have to ask the question, how much omega-3 fat is in there? And the answer is pitifully little. And not only that, it's the wrong kind. It's alpha-linolenic acid, not the DHA and the EPA that we find in fish. But marketers, of course, don't care about that. But of course, there's another question that we can ask. If you want omega-3 fats from flaxseed, why do you have to go through the middleman? Why do you need the chicken? You don't. You can just eat the flaxseed directly. Or, in fact, you can use that flaxseed and make flaxseed bread or other commodities like the flaxseed bagel. Well, as you well know, Montreal is the mecca of bageldom. We have bagels of all kinds, including flaxseed bagels. 20 grams of ground flaxseed in that bagel. Why 20 grams? Because research at University of Toronto, Canada's second best university, has It's funny, a couple of weeks ago I used that line at U of T and it didn't get that response. Seriously speaking, because there is research that women who have had breast cancer who consume 20 grams of ground flaxseed per day have a lower incidence of recurrence. I mean, serious research. 20 grams, though, is a lot. Well, they've squeezed 20 grams of ground flaxseed into that bagel. Of course, the bagel is inedible, but it does have the 20 grams of ground flaxseed. Now, I think most of us would rather eat its cousin, which is the donut, in terms of taste. But you know what? The only features that the bagel and the donut have in common is geometry. With the bagel, you can eat the whole thing. With the donut, you should restrict yourself to the whole. Although I've been told that to get to the whole, you have to eat through the donut. Right? Well, why do I say this? Why do I make fun of this particular food? Because I think I can demonstrate scientifically the reason. If you've ever been to a Krispy Kreme Emporium and looked at the donuts, they look something like that. They're usually some sort of topping, and you can imagine that if those are consumed, what it does to you. But if you have a real close-up look at it, as you can do when you go into one of the places where they make this, and you can view this, they have a plexiglass shield, and you can see this being done. I don't understand why they show you. If I were making donuts like that, I would want to hide that operation, not demonstrate it. Because you see the donuts floating by in the hot boiling fat, but you see the pipe at the back. That's through where fresh fat gushes in because so much is absorbed by the donuts that it constantly has to be replenished. Then they go under the glazer, where they are loaded up with another layer of sugar and fat. And needless to say, that fat is laden with the trans variety, and that is what drives up your cholesterol, and presto, what you have is a heart attack on a plate. The word cholesterol, of course, is frightening. Even people who have no idea what cholesterol is want to have less of it in their life than more. And, you know, any time that there's new research that comes out that shows that there's some way of easily lowering your cholesterol level, people jump on that bandwagon. Many of you will recall about a decade ago the fascinating research that indicated that oat bran, the outside covering of the oat, would reduce cholesterol levels. That made headline news. Now, before we learned about this, oat bran was a cheap commodity that was sold as animal food. In fact, farmers couldn't get rid of it. All of a sudden, it became a quasi-medicine. They took it out of the mouths of horses, and they put it on our breakfast plate. So we were eating oat bran. What did that leave for the horses? So we were eating their food. They were eating ours. Oat bran mania was underway. All kinds of foods contained oat bran, dirty potato chips, never mind the dirt, as long as it also had oat bran. We thought that all of our dietary sins would be forgiven if only we could squeeze more oats into our life. But there was a problem here. The problem was that most people did not ask the pertinent question. Said, all right, well, eating oat bran lowers our cholesterol, but question is, how much of this foul stuff do we have to stuff into ourselves to lower our cholesterol? That's of real interest. Let's clarify that. The active ingredient in the oat bran is the soluble fiber we call beta-glucan. And it really does lower cholesterol. It reacts with bile acids in the gut. Bile acids are made from cholesterol. If the cholesterol that's excreted, or the bile acids that are excreted into the gut, are not recycled back into the body, as they normally would be, because now they are trapped by the fiber, then the body has to use more cholesterol in order to synthesize more bile acids, so the level of cholesterol goes down. This can be experimentally shown. But you need about 3 grams of beta-glucan a day to have any effect on blood cholesterol. Well, what does that mean in practical terms? 3 grams of beta-glucan translates roughly to about 1 cup of oat bran cereal. Now, those of you who have ever eaten oat bran, I think, will testify that this is not one of God's gifts to the palate. So you have to dress it up somehow. You can add some applesauce, you can add berries. That's great. It's doable, with some difficulty. Oat bran muffins, possible. Oatmeal, 1.5 cups a day. Yeah, that's certainly doable. So the oat bran saga is rolling merrily along on that bandwagon because nobody was asking the question about how much. And advertisers, of course, were quick to jump on this. General Mills realized all of a sudden that the O in Cheerios stands for oat bran. I suspect that prior to this research, they didn't even know that their product was made of oats. But I would like to point out that the O also stands for zero, which is pretty close to the amount of oat bran that is in there, because you'd have to eat 5 servings of Cheerios a day in order to get your 3 grams of beta-glucan. But you won't find that number on any kind of a label, because they don't want to encourage the public to think scientifically, that is to think in terms of numbers. It is very, very good for them if people just think in terms of, is it there or is it not there? They've heard of all the slogans about omega-3 fats, about lignans, about beta-glucan. They just look to see, is it there or not? But of course, that's not the way science works. Science revolves around numbers. But in the alternative literature or the pseudoscientific literature, numbers are forgotten. If you go into bookstores these days, you are likely to find these kind of books: Eat Away Your Illness, Nutritional Prescription, Live Forever, etc. The one that I like to pick on is Fit for Life. Why? Because it's been around for about 20 years. It goes on and off the bestseller list. What a fascinating little book this is. Written by Harvey and Marilyn Diamond, here shown about 20 years ago. They have since divorced, each one marrying someone half their age. You decide who did better. They portrayed themselves as the knights in shining armor who were going to protect us from that unholy alliance between scientists, physicians, big pharma, and government, who, of course, are trying to undermine our health with all of their pesticides and microwaves and non-organic foods, and are trying to sell the public expensive, ineffective drugs to try to cure diseases that they caused. That's the message that you get, and they're not alone in that. This is the message that you get in many, many of these books. They portray the scientific world as being evil. Well, their scientific knowledge is very limited, as one might expect, because they do have no scientific education whatsoever. Of course, that never has been a prerequisite for writing books for the public. Let's look at one of the little passages in this epic work. Within atoms and molecules reside the elements known as enzymes. Enzymes are not things or substances. They're the life principle in the atoms and molecules of every living cell. Now, I would suspect that, you know, for anyone who knows even a touch of science, if they would open this book and read that paragraph, that would be enough to close the book and throw it out, because, I mean, this is obviously evidence of their scientific illiteracy. But this idea sells. For these deluded people, enzymes are some kind of intangible property of food, something like the human soul, which we may or may not have. I'm sure they think I don't. And if you destroy the enzymes, you destroy whatever nutritional property that they give the food and therefore our body. The fact, of course, is that we do not require any enzymes from an outside source. In fact, they're just proteins that are obviously just digested. We synthesize all the enzymes that we need. Very interesting people, the Diamonds. They even delve into our love life, believe it or not. They tell us that women must not have pleasure during pregnancy because it cuts off the oxygen supply to the fetus and results in inferior brain development. Well, what an interesting hypothesis that is. And as we heard from Professor Thies earlier, the way that science progresses, so you make an observation, you design a theory, you do some more experiments, you see if you can make a lot of it, then you test it to see whether or not it stands up to the rigors of research and evidence. Well, think about this. If you have this hypothesis, how could you ever design an experiment to see if this were true or not, right? So what we have here is pure conjecture. That's all that we have. The only thing we can say scientifically here is that if this were true, then Harvey and Marilyn Diamond's parents must have had one humdinger of a love life. They tell us that the greatest threat to health is processed food. Well, I'm not in favor of processed food. Of course, there are a lot of crappy processed foods out there. But the fact is that food processing has increased our health, not degraded it. We have far fewer cases of food poisoning now than we've ever had. Food science has taken giant leaps. It's absurd to suggest that food processing is a backward step. Well, what examples do they use for this? They point fingers at additives, because chemists, of course, are the evil people who put additives into food just to see what new cancer-causing substance they can unleash on the unsuspecting public. Where is this evident? For example, in sliced white bread. I'm not a big proponent of sliced white bread. Yes, we should be eating whole grain bread. But you know what? People have eaten sliced white bread and survived. But if you read their book, you would think that's not possible. Why? Because it contains chemicals. Which chemicals? Preservatives. Well, yes, sliced white bread does contain preservatives. Why? Because if it doesn't, within about 3 days, this is what it looks like. And market studies have shown that people do not buy this kind of bread. And of course, they should not, because what you're looking at here is a collage of toxins. Indeed, the most carcinogenic substance that is known, a set of compounds called aflatoxins, which are produced by molds. So what we do is add some calcium propionate to the bread. Calcium propionate is a preservative. It prevents mold growth. Contrary to what many people think, a company doesn't just decide, gee, calcium propionate we think can impair mold growth, let's dump some of this into our bread. That's not how it works. We have regulatory agencies which are very stringent. Here, Health Canada and the US FDA, and you have to jump through a lot of hoops and over many hurdles before you get an additive approved. In the case of calcium propionate, this was not very difficult because propionates, in fact, are metabolic products of fat. Any fat that we eat gets converted, of course, to numerous compounds, one of which are the propionates. So they're present in our body. We even sweat them out. If we do an analysis of our underarm secretions, you'll find propionates. Preservatives and underarm sweat, which is interesting because it explains a mysterious facet of French life. If any of you have been to France and bought a baguette, you know that you have to eat it within about 17 seconds of buying it because they don't use any preservatives, right? But you know the traditional way the Frenchman carries his baguette home. It's the ultimate in natural preservation, right? Well, talking about the French, how can we not mention the French paradox in this context? The notion here, of course, is that we have 50 million or so Frenchmen who have fewer heart attacks than we have in North America, despite a diet that includes all kinds of foods that we would think would predispose them to an early death. And yet the coronary artery death rate in France is one quarter of that in North America, despite the croissant, you squeeze one and butter drips out, the high-fat cheeses, the foie gras. How can this be that there are fewer heart attacks? Well, there's one possible answer. The French watch more Jerry Lewis movies per capita than anyone in the world. We have a very strong association between reduced risk of heart disease and watching Jerry Lewis movies. Is it cause and effect? One would hesitate to say that. If anything, he causes heart attacks, he doesn't prevent them. But there is such an association. But of course, this is not the association that the French wine industry promotes. It is the red wine. Indeed, in France, you guys drink 30 times as much red wine as we do here in North America, and you have a reduced risk of heart disease, right? Although there are some statistical anomalies there, if you really want to look at it carefully, because there are many French death certificates that just show sudden death without clarifying just what that is. But anyway, the French wine industry, of course, heavily promotes the idea that red wine is effective in reducing the risk. Well, is that cause and effect? This is where one has to be very careful. I mean, before we start giving our children alcohol supplements, you want to make sure that we have the evidence. Because after all, you know, I mean, there are people who believe that storks bring babies, correct? Well, after the Second World War in Europe, the birth rate declined dramatically, and the stork population in cities declined as well. Does that give us evidence that storks bring babies? No. Storks moved out of cities because of pollution. The birth rate went down because television was introduced and people had other things to do at night. So one has to be very careful before an association gets interpreted as cause and effect. But in the case of red wine, we want to look into it carefully because there is a compound in there called resveratrol, which in proper serious laboratory investigations does give some hope for some health benefit. It is an antioxidant, and there is research suggesting that it might have some effect on heart disease and, in fact, even on cancer. However, the red wine is a very, very complex mixture of many chemicals, including alcohol, which is a known carcinogen. Ethanol is a cancer-causing compound. If ethanol did not exist, if it was just made by a food company and put on the market, or attempt to be put on the market, it would never be allowed. Health Canada would never approve it, FDA would never approve it, because a known cancer-causing agent cannot be put on the market. But it's natural, so it's okay. We can get natural cancer, it's a synthetic variety that we have to worry about. The evidence, in fact, is clear. Unfortunately, the million women study that was carried out last year in England, very, very strong study, indeed looked at virtually a million women and showed a very, very clear risk of breast cancer with alcohol intake with unfortunately no threshold effect. So the question is, can we get the benefit of resveratrol without the carcinogenicity of the alcohol? Well, the marketers tell us that we can, and they sell resveratrol. The fact is that resveratrol is a very labile compound. It's very difficult to put into a pill unless you have it in a capsule under a nitrogen atmosphere, which is not what they have. So there would be a very small dose. And another thing, of course, that they don't tell you is that the laboratory evidence, which basically comes from rats, and the fact, of course, is that the human is not a giant rat, with some exceptions, obviously, but by and large. So you have to be careful about the interpretation of those rat studies. But the rat studies had an equivalent of 100 bottles of red wine of resveratrol. These supplements have virtually the equivalent of one bottle. So again, numbers matter. But if you don't talk about numbers, it's easy to lead people down the garden path. One can make a case for resveratrol as being a virtually miraculous dietary supplement. Well, I like to lead people down the garden path too, but what I tell them, stop along the way and pick the fruits and pick the vegetables, because that's where health lies. Broccoli, for example, contains sulforaphane. Well, it doesn't actually contain it, but sulforaphane forms when we bite into the broccoli. And again, in laboratory experiments, that has anti-cancer properties. The berries that we talk so much about. Well, there's a lot of interesting science there as well. Unfortunately, the relationship to cancer is not as strong as we used to think, but to heart disease, it is. The more fruits and vegetables we eat, the lower the incidence. Not all of this study comes from rodents, although most of it does. The blueberry studies basically are based upon on rats, but they're very interesting studies because you can always gauge the age of rats by their ability to walk on ropes or on narrow ledges. Indeed, when a rat ages, it loses its ability to maintain its balance. So you can always tell the age of your rats. If you go down to your basement and you see your rats cleverly running across tight ropes, you know that you have a nice young population. But if they're falling off, then you've got some seniors, and you better get out the blueberries, because what the research shows is that you can reduce the rate at which they lose their balance by giving them blueberries. Interesting, but that's in rats. Life, however, is like walking a tightrope, isn't it? We know that eventually we're going to fall off. We want to stay on there as long as possible. There's no real magic in blueberries, but it's very possible that giving large doses to rats over a short time kind of mimics us eating blueberries regularly over a long term. It's not that blueberries are drugs, But there's something that merits being featured in the diet because at least we have some evidence for it. But once again, the advertisers will go beyond the evidence. Total Cereal now has blueberry and pomegranate featured on the label. But that's all it has, because if you look at the ingredients, conspicuous by their absence are blueberries or pomegranates. Well, they're actually hidden in the artificial or natural flavor there. But this is pure advertising hype. Total Cereal is total nonsense. There are no blueberries or pomegranates in there. It's not a particularly bad cereal. At least sugar isn't the first ingredient. But obviously, it is misleading to suggest that this has blueberries and pomegranates. Now, there are people who say, yes, it's good to eat all of these fruits and vegetables and berries, but what about the downside? What about the pesticide residues? Well, yes, we do have pesticide residues. And let's face it, pesticides are toxic. They are designed to be. What is a pesticide? It's designed to kill a pest. Luckily, those pests are smaller than us. So something that kills them, hopefully, is harmless to us. But with our increasing analytical techniques, we can find that virtually everything has some contaminant. Why? Because my colleagues, the analytical chemists, are so good. Today, with the gas chromatographs and the mass spectrometers, they can find things down to parts per trillion. That's 1 second in 32,000 years. That's unbelievable. I keep telling them that they are the root of all of our problems. Because eventually, of course, you find everything is contaminated by everything else. Of course, what really matters is whether or not those small traces matter. What do we know about those numbers relative to numbers about toxicity? And the fact is that those residues are way below what we know to be toxic. Anyone who gives up eating conventional produce because they're worried about pesticide residues is doing themselves a disservice. The organic market, of course, is flourishing, mostly based upon the fallacious idea that trace amounts of pesticide residues are a problem. They're completely oblivious of the fact that more than 99% of all of the pesticides that we consume come from natural origins, because plants, fruits, berries all produce compounds in an attempt to ward off predators like insects and fungi. And the human body does not differentiate between natural pesticides and the synthetic ones. As Paracelsus told us 500 years ago, it is only the dose that makes the poison. One of the best ways to illustrate that is by taking a look at an apple. Better yet, take a bite out of that apple. What are you really tasting? Well, this is what you're tasting. That's the collage of chemicals. That's what you're going to put together to make us an apple, right? Over 300 different compounds, right? These have been isolated. We know that that's what the apple is made of. Well, that includes acetone. The last time you encountered that was probably on the label of your nail polish remover, right above where it says, do not drink. But you also have in there formaldehyde. That's embalming fluid. And formaldehyde, of course, has gotten a lot of bad press because formaldehyde, toxic, carcinogenic, etc. So I could tell you, boy, you know, you're eating an apple, you're risking your life because you're eating acetone. That's a toxin that can kill you. But it's actually an economical way to go because you will be pre-embalmed. Of course, it would be absurd to say anything like that because the amounts are trivial. The acetone and the formaldehyde are minor components relative to the beneficial compounds, the antioxidants like the polyphenols that are present in there. But it is possible, as you can see, to cherry pick data and twist and turn it to whatever advantage you want to put it. So that apple is not killing us. In fact, eating an apple a day is a good thing to do. I mean, we all heard the expression, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, that's, of course, only if you throw it at him or her. But metaphorically, it does work because it represents eating more fruits and vegetables. And that is what the epidemiological evidence tells us, that the closer we are to a diet that has 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, the better off we are. Now, there are no perfect foods, no matter what advertisers suggest, and that's a wrong way to think about it. Foods are not to be looked at as angels or indeed as devils. What we have to do is look at the overall diet, basically looking at it in terms of chemical composition. We have to examine the compounds that make up every food, what we know about, what happens to these once they get into our body. It is confusing. I'll be the first one to admit this. I mean, I've been in this business for close to 40 years. It's confusing. How can it be anything but? Food is extremely complex. You sniff the aroma of coffee, and you're sniffing over 1,000 compounds. The total number of compounds that we consume during a day probably runs into hundreds of thousands. And we're putting this into the most complex machine on the face of the earth, which is the human body. How can you come up with something simple? Only if you're a simpleton. And many pseudoscientists, of course, are. And that's why they have miraculous answers to our problems. That's why they suggest that there are things like superfoods, which, of course, vary day by day, depending on, you know, what's in vogue. One day it might be the acai berry. Next day it might be African mango, depending on what the current research suggests, or at least what they have taken out of context from the current research. Some maintain that there is a cure in our cupboard. In this particular case, it's oil of oregano, which is the miracle. If you look at this book, anything from allergies to zits responds to oil of oregano. The fact is that even a pizza doesn't respond well to oil of oregano, right? It's a taste component. That's all that it is. And yet here it is being portrayed as some kind of a medicine. In fact, this is just the wrong way to look at things, to look at individual foods like that. It's basically the wrong concept. So what is the right concept? The right concept is not nearly as seductive, because telling people to eat mostly fruits and vegetables and exercise is not as romantic as suggesting that if you eat African mango, everything is going to be okay. But we do know a lot about nutrition, so we can certainly offer some guidelines. We know that obesity is a bad thing. It really is. It predisposes us to cancer. Virtually every type of cancer, the risk increases with obesity. And in North America, we have an epidemic of obesity. Not only that, we're exporting it. And now we're exporting it to Japan, we're exporting it to China. You're beginning to see things that we've never seen before. Why did we have to change the name of adult onset diabetes to type 2 diabetes? Because it was no longer adult onset. Kids are getting diabetes early. That's why the name change came about. In the U.S., they're trying to do something about it by publishing calorie content on fast food menus. It has done absolutely nothing because people cannot relate to the numbers. They don't understand what it means. We are consuming a tremendous amount of sugar in North America. A lot of that comes in soft drinks. The serving sizes are gigantic. If you go to an amusement park in the U.S., you see some sights there that humans should never see. You see people walking around with containers of soft drinks that in other countries could serve as bathtubs. And they're sucking on these from morning to night, destroying their teeth and, of course, destroying their health. The amount of sugar in there is astounding. I don't particularly mean to pick on Coke. It's just representative of soft drinks. But that's the amount of sugar that you have in a small can of Coke. Normally, you have the 344 milliliters, which is bigger than that. Now, the truth, of course, is that we also have the same amount of sugar in apple juice or in orange juice, but at least there, it's not empty calories because you're getting vitamins, you're getting some minerals, and you're getting all of the phytonutrients along with it. So at least, yeah, the calories are there, but it's not only the calories that you're getting, like in a soft drink. I've often said that if there were one change that we could make in North America that would have the biggest possible effect on improving health, it would be to eliminate soft drinks. This is never... This is never going to happen, of course, because the industry is gigantic. It's never going to happen. But doesn't mean we can't work towards it. The way we cook our food, which of course we've heard a great deal about, is also instrumental. Cooking foods at very high temperature, contraindicated because you're forming all the polycyclic hydrocarbons and glycation end products. If we can cook it at a lower temperature, so much the better. Stewing the meat is better. But even then, you read some of the literature, it will portray meat as being, you know, death warrant if you eat it. But here, too, numbers matter. Indeed, if you are going to go for the triple bypass burger, which actually exists, of course, you have to go to the southern U.S., to the Heart Attack Grill, but it's not a bad place to have a heart attack because they are ready to administer to you. Yeah, overindulgence is the problem. But then again, you flip through the pages of the next journal and you find that saturated fat risk is overblown. So it kind of makes you crazy. But poultry is better. It has less fat. You don't cook it at high temperature. You don't cook it for as long. And, of course, fish has all of the benefits of the omega-3 fats. Of course, there's mercury in there, but if you're not pregnant, it is not a great issue. Processed meats, unfortunately, are a no-no. I hate to say this. My background is Hungarian. Hungarians are dedicated carnivores. In Hungary, salami is a vegetable. tofu is illegal. But you know what? You've got to go by the research, and the research is that it predisposes you to colorectal cancer. It doesn't mean you never eat it, but not something to eat every day. That's where the diet should be. I don't relish saying that. You know, I wish it was a charcoal broiled steak, french fries, coleslaw, dill pickle, but it isn't. It's not going to be. This is what we really have to think about is eating more plant-based foods. Kids don't like that idea. They're scared of these things. We have to try to educate them. And numbers, it's not a question of just eating it once in a while. It has to be regular. That's what the epidemiological evidence tells us. But people say, I can't do that. Instead, I'll take a dietary supplement. I'll take a multivitamin. Very questionable. The latest studies, of course, show us that the health benefits are not there. When you take them out of the food, you put them into a pill, it's not there. There's some kind of interaction between all the nutrients in the food that is missing when you put them into a pill. And whether you're talking about vitamin A, B, or C, doesn't matter. This is what we see over again, with maybe one exception, and that's the vitamin D. There's pretty good evidence that anywhere from 400 to 1,000 IU a day is probably a good thing to do, and there's no downside to that. So that's sort of nutrition in a capsule. This is what I think the public needs to be informed about. Nutrition needs to be put into proper context so that they can stretch out their years. Because we all want to do that, right? We all want to live a long time. We all want to overcome the hurdles of life. And food is one way that we can help do that, because we are indeed composed of what we eat. But just to finish off here, while we have fun, we talk about cooking in many ways. We talk about the subtleties of taste, etc., and whether or not we have monosodium glutamate as an additive present in our food. Whereas so many people in the world go to bed hungry every night. In fact, every 3.5 seconds, somebody in the world dies purely from not having enough food to eat. Indeed, since I started here today, there are roughly 1,000 people who are no longer with us because they purely did not have enough food to eat. They would be very happy to have our additive-laden GMO foods instead of what they have to subsist on. So it's kind of a luxury for us to be in this pleasant atmosphere, having eaten a wonderful lunch and good snacks, and be able to talk about what we've talked about, but we should also recognize what is going on in the rest of the world. And I suspect that this has raised some questions, which I'd be happy to answer, and I'm sure the other speakers as well. But coming from a scientific background, one thing that I do have to admit, that no matter what we do and what kind of experiments we carry out, we don't always come up with an answer, because there are some questions that just cannot be answered. But we do our best. So certainly we'd be happy to try to answer any of your questions. And I think what hopefully we've been able to do here today is to whet your appetite, not only for some good food, but also for some good science. Thank you.